the power, and in my opinion, the ethical responsibility to maintain minimal standards for timely dental care. I know you have to cut the budget, but do it wisely. Hands-off dental services, which are an integral part for maintaining overall health. Members, you do have some tough decisions to make, but I believe that you can get this one right. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Graves. Questions? In the Finance Committee the other day, it was pointed out that the governor's budget eliminates dental care totally for people on general assistance, medical care, and other of our public health programs. There are those who would believe that if these folks are going to lose their dental care, it would be not inappropriate for folks under correctional supervision to also lose some part of dental care. Would you care
yes,
to try
be,
to address that?
I'd be happy to answer that. No one, you know, I'll go on the record. I'm more liberal than Paul Wellstone. I believe, I really am, and I'm proud to admit it, I believe that it should be a right, just frankly as President Obama does as well, for us to have a right to some level of health care. But I refer you back to Estelle versus Gamble. Again, not my decision, not the bureaucrats over here, not their decision, Supreme Court case law establishing the right for offenders to have medical and dental care. And that's what I meant, Senator, when I talked about the great paradox, is that, you know, look at us. I mean, none of us, unless we're offenders, are entitled to some level of health care. And it is quite distressing for me as a dental hygienist who's worked in a public health setting, who was quite interested in the oral health practitioner bill that I've been watching closely. No one's more aware of how disgusting that is. But the big difference, Senator, is that they have a constitutional right. Honest to God, they do. So I remember one of the, I believe it was one of the senators at my last testimony, she asked a good question, but we don't have the constitutional right, but when you lock somebody in a cage, they still maintain four basic rights, and one of them is to timely dental care. And finally, I can't tell you enough, if you are going to send a level 5 offender to Abbott Northwestern and spend I don't even know how much money on the new Da Vinci surgical device to operate on his testicles, if we send a helicopter from North Memorial Hospital to Abbott Northwestern, that's $1,000 a mile. At Oak Park Heights, I took care of cancer patients, dialysis patients, end of stage. These men were dying. Do you want to spend that kind of medical money in the budget and have those guys go downhill from a dental infection? Under Nan Larson's proposal, those guys at Oak Park Heights, I'll speak for my own former facility because that's really what I know the best, Oak Park Heights would have a dentist there one day a month. You can't have a hospital. You cannot do these expensive medical procedures and not take care of their dental needs. A dental infection can kill you. Okay, so
I'm breaking my own 3-minute rule here.
All right.
So.
Did you so much. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the witness's input, but I have to, for the record and for posterity, I don't think we lock people up in cages, even though metaphorically some people might feel that that's the case, and I just,
so noted.
We are the legislature.
Well, you may want to consider asking a man in the administrative control unit at Oak Park Heights if he can. I mean, I'm not saying they don't justify being there, but.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Gary Hurd from Smarles. Welcome.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Gary Hurd. I'm the Chief Operating Officer with Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services. Jerry Lane, the Executive Director of Mid-Minnesota Legal Assistance, was hoping to address you tonight, but his wife purchased theater tickets for him for his birthday.
Yay.
And in our continuing effort to reduce the number of court cases, He wisely chose to theater tonight. I'd like to echo the other parts of the justice system and thank both chambers and their committees for the hard work that has obviously gone into the two bills that are here in the conference committee. We understand that this was an incredibly difficult job, that both chambers were working under different constraints. Both committees worked very hard to limit the impact of the budget shortfalls on the justice system as a whole, and civil legal services as an important partner in that system. Unfortunately, because of changes made right at the end of the 2007 session, the civil legal services increase that year of $1 million was not added into our base. As a result, we started this budget process 7.5% behind the rest of the justice system. As a result, we urge this committee to adopt the House provisions on the appropriations, which will still result in an 8.3% reduction to our current funding. Lastly, we'd like to urge the committee to adopt the Senate language in Article 2 on page R47, dealing with the public defender fee. The Senate language, we believe, clarifies that the legislature's intent is not to automatically increase the public defender fee if the Supreme Court were to increase the attorney registration fee devoted to fund civil legal services. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Was it Jerry Lane that you said was out with his wife tonight?
Yes, for the record.
All right. Okay, Steve Thomas from the network. And Jennifer McDonald on deck. Dan Kunze in the hole, as they say. Mr. Thomas, go right ahead.
Madam Chair, thank you. Good evening, everyone. I know it's a long evening, so we'll be short and sweet. And on my left is Mr. Vincent Britton, and on my right is Mr. Willie Jenkins, two members, participants in the Network for Better Futures. In the few minutes we have, on behalf of the seven founding partners and the more than 250 men who have enrolled in the network over the past 16 months, we encourage you to find a creative and appropriate way to continue investing in the growth of the network over the next biennium. Tonight, we just want to do two things. One is for me to give you a reminder that nearly 3 years ago, the seven founding partners, some of the leading nonprofits in the Twin Cities area, came together in order to get much better results for a group of clients of theirs who had high rates of failure, and primarily those are African-American men with histories of chronic homelessness, multiple incarcerations, poor health outcomes. They collectively invested over $300,000 of their own funds to design this innovative endeavor, and we attracted nearly $3.5 million of private money so far to help cover the startup cost. And with the generous investment of this committee, the last biennium of $1.6 million, we're producing very promising and very measurable outcomes. And before I suggest some actions that we'd like your conference committee to consider as you enter in your deliberations, I would just like Vincent to take a minute to speak to you on behalf of all the men who are in the network.
Very quickly, please. Welcome.
Ms. Vincent Britton, and I just want to say that I'm thankful for the network and the opportunity to get my life started and on track, being released from prison a little bit over a year ago. And I'm in the process now of doing things that I've never done in my life as far as being a citizen. I couldn't have done it without the network, and I just want to say that I'm proud to say that I'm going to start MCTC June 1st and for addiction counseling, and I'm just making great strides in my life, and that's just one of the things that I just wanted to share with the council. But I couldn't have done it without the network and the community of men that's involved in the network, and there are guys out here that wants to be better people. I just want to share that.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
If just close, we encourage the committee to accept and strengthen the Senate's language that is in the bill regarding the high-risk demonstration, and specifically to come up with some language that sends a strong signal to the Department of Public Safety that our endeavor is not only a highly effective demonstration, but one that should continue to be funded with a portion of the state's federal stimulus funds. And I might add, the primary reason for the stimulus dollars is to create jobs. And we've already created 25 full-time equivalent jobs for high-risk men, most of whom don't find many employment opportunities in this community. And at our continued growth, we could add another 22 jobs, full-time equivalent jobs, on top of those 25 jobs that we've already created. So that's our suggestion, and we wish you well, and we appreciate all your hard work.
Thank you so much. Would your other testifier like to say a couple of sentences?
Willie, do you want to tell him what I told you?
Told me to stay here and look pretty. So.
Me, I thought that was my job. Thank you all for staying for so many hours tonight.
Thank you.
Jennifer McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair. Jennifer McDonald, Restorative Justice Community Action, and I also serve on the board of Minnesota Restorative Services Coalition. The subdivision 6 on page R12A1, I just ask that both the House and the Senate are give a priority to restorative justice programs in the stimulus funds, and just ask that hopefully stay in. There's some little different language between the two, and thank you. The crime victim and youth intervention, those are on the next page on R12A1. The House file lines 9.12 to 9.22, I would encourage you to consider including those and supporting those programs. Even though it's not specifically stated to restorative justice, at the heart of restorative justice is healing the harm, which is really focused on the victim, and the victim crime victim services that exist at the Department of Corrections and at the Department of Public Safety are very important programs for our public safety and for rehabilitating offenders. Then under community services, on page R25A1, this is all obvious, you know this, but lines 17.11 to 17.17, and I didn't write down whether that was the House or Senate. It's in the House file, and I ask that the Senate consider adding it in as well. It talks about the commissioner shall apply for all available grants for federal funds under the American Recovery Act and the Second Chance Act. In order to receive those funds, of course, and to not only continue but also expand both reentry and restorative justice programs. At this time, the restorative justice programs that are operated by the Department of Corrections, as you know, Victim Offender Dialogues, VOCARI, which is a surrogate victim offender dialogue, Exploring Justice, are programs that are retained in the current budget, and this would be an opportunity to possibly expand those further and provide more of those services, and possibly to continue funding to the community-based programs that have been cut. So we encourage you to consider adding that in the final omnibus bill. And then finally, in Senate file, Article 3, it's on page R35-A2, and it's through page R37. To retain that policy language, we appreciate that policy language was added to the finance bill. It puts in place statewide procedure that's already in place for the most part in partnership with the prosecutor's office, both at the Hennepin County and City of Minneapolis, for providing restorative justice diversion programs for both juveniles and adults. It's not an unfunded mandate because the language specifically says if the program's available. in the long run, this process saves money for not only the government, but also for the organizations that provide restorative justice programs, because by a good amount of the energy and resources that we use is trying to let offenders know about our program and that it's something available to them. And we do that by working with the police department to get information to people when they're cited. We do it through sending letters to people when they're cited. We get that information from the police department. And through the prosecutor's office, making referrals, and then ultimately through the probation, making referrals of low-level offenders and juvenile offenders. But we do a lot of spend a lot of time educating prosecutors and police and public defenders and everybody within the court system, as well as probation officers, about the program and its availability and how easy it is to refer people to our program. This bill puts restorative justice as part of the process when somebody is cited with a low-level offense for adults, first-time offenders for juveniles, and it in the long run makes it part of the standard process so that we don't have to spend a lot of resources trying to let people know that this is an option that's available to them. And then, of course, people who enroll in the program, they save the courts money by being diverted and not going through the court system. And with the lower recidivism rate, they reduce costs in the long run because they're not reoffending. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Lesh.
Thanks. I was quickly trying to look at the language that I saw. I'm sure it was Article 1 or Article 3. But in the recommendations of the programs, I think in Minneapolis, isn't the proposal from the Senate to have the prosecutor compile the list of the programs? And my question is, why can't you guys just do it?
It was originally written that the court would compile the list, and the court didn't want to have that burden. And at the time that the language was changed at the Senate hearing, there was a city prosecutor from the city of Minneapolis there who said it's not a burden on them to compile the list because they already have contracts with restorative justice programs who are doing the services. We could, if that's what would be preferred. The Minnesota Restorative Services Coalition has offered trying to put together an 800 number for, 1-800 restorative justice for people to call and find out what programs are available statewide. Whatever the statewide Restorative Services Coalition can do to simplify referrals to restorative justice programs throughout the state, we would be happy to do. So if there's language change that needs to be to happen, we'd be happy to talk with you and with the prosecutors to see what would work for them.
Okay, and thanks, Madam Chair. And the reason I ask is, I don't know about the burden, but I just had some concerns, adversarial concerns regarding one side, even though I'm a prosecutor, compiling a list of from which an offender may be able to choose. So
that's
I look forward
point.
To working with you on that.
Okay. John Stewart is a big proponent of restorative justice and actually works with the Minnesota Restorative Services Coalition on our training conference that we have every other year. So I'm sure we could work something out between the two organizations, the two sides, as you put it.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question about restorative justice and what impact this language might have on the diversion programs that already exist and some of the, when we aren't actually prosecuting some of these first-time juvenile petty offenders at all. I mean, is this going to create a situation where we might actually be doing more? And so if we could have some discussion later on and not all right now, but.
Okay. All right. We'll note that. Okay. Thanks, Ms. McDonald.
Thank you very much.
Nice to see you again. And
thank you for all of your hard work, too, echoing what Sue Dosal said earlier.
Thank you. Leanne Kunze is next, and Andy Erickson is on deck. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of committee. My name is Leanne Kunze, and I'm a staff representative with AFSCME Council 65. That stands for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And I, in that role, I serve as a statewide liaison for Greater Minnesota AFSCME-represented court employees. And I represent mainly the frontline employees who partner with the judges in providing quality access to justice. At the risk of sounding redundant, I too would like to thank both the House and the Senate for your hard work and know this has been a pretty tough session and implore you for what you've done. As you know from earlier hearings, the district courts have been underfunded for several years, along with the transitioning process from county funding to state funding. Knowing this, I appreciate the fact that you have acknowledged that any level of cuts is going to be significant and have an inevitable negative impact on Minnesota's statutory right to justice. We already have employees in layoff status over 12 months. So with the versions before you, it is my hope that you will adopt the House version of allotment that minimizes cuts to the judicial branch and has the best chance at maintaining Minnesota's right, statutory right, to justice.
Thank you very much. Questions? All right, Mr. Erickson and Cindy Cook on deck. Nice to see you.
Good evening. Andy Erickson, Deputy Director for Probation Services for Adult Probation Services in Ramsey County. I was also asked to speak on behalf of Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties and the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'm here to speak to the differences in the House and the Senate bill, specifically as it relates to line 182. Which is the different approaches to the pass-through funding to counties as it relates to public service. It's tempting to say, you know, probation is all about public safety. But when I thought about it, I had some time to think about it here this evening, and I realized that everyone here is all about public safety, and that's why we're here. We just play different roles. In this county, Ramsey County, where this Capitol building sits, we have 16,000 offenders in the community living and many of them working and those kinds of things. And the kinds of things that probation officers do, they monitor court conditions, they test for drug use, they try to help find housing, employment, but they try to keep the offenders from reoffending. And because of the difficulty that I know you are in, I think it's only fair to mention, sort of as an illustration briefly, of some of the things that we've done in Ramsey County Adult Probation to cut just within this last year or so. We now spend one-fourth as much as we did 5 years ago on treatment for those convicted of domestic abuse, sex offenses, and chemical abuse. So we've cut that pot of money by three-quarters over the last 5 years. We've aggressively increased fee revenues from our offenders. We've doubled it in the last 3 years, the amount of money we get from the offenders themselves. We've developed a phone reporting center for low-risk offenders, which now provides supervision for 5,000 of those 16,000, a phone reporting center. That's a third of our total offender population. We currently have a hiring freeze in place, and we delay hiring even for our critical positions. And because of the expected cuts to local government aid, and the parameters our county manager has set for us, we're looking to cut for next year between 5 and 9 probation officer positions. And in terms of ideas about what we might do, the Senate bill, as you know, makes a bigger reduction than what happens on the House side. But if the Senate bill were to pass, and these are just illustrative because I know counties are going to respond differently to this loss if it were to occur, the Senate proposal would cut an estimated additional $500,000 from our corrections budget in Ramsey County. So to accomplish that, we looked at what we would likely do. We would likely reduce contact standards in the field, so see offenders less often. We currently subsidize, I don't know if that's the right term, but augment maybe is a better word, the intensive supervised release program, the state-funded program. We spend several hundred thousand dollars in local levy to make that happen. We would have to look at reducing some of our levy commitment to that program, possibly cutting an agent, so that becomes more funded by the state, but it would be a smaller crew of agents. We would further reduce treatment services, short-term housing options for offenders just released from prison. We'd likely increase the number of offenders being supervised by each agent, currently 70 to 80 per agent, probably up to about a 90 plus per probation officer. We have three field units. We'd likely close one of them and consolidate and move staff and increase spans of control and those kinds of things. And we likely do something with our drug testing budget. We've already cut $100,000 out of our drug testing budget in the last 2 years. We'd likely go further and or look at some offender fees to cover those things. I'm thrilled to be here to offer, you know, our scenario and open to comments, concerns, complaints, and thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Erickson? Sure, we'll see you in the next few days, too.
Cindy Cook and Donna Dunn is on deck.
Or possibly coming to the table together. All right. Who'd ever like to start? Go right ahead.
Madam Chair, my name is Cindy Cook. I'm the director of the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women, and if it would please the chair, I would like to defer to my colleague Donna Dunn to start us off tonight.
Okay.
Thank you. Good evening. And my name is Donna Dunn. I am the director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and as such, I represent 70 advocacy programs that provide services to sexual assault victims across the state of Minnesota. Thank you for this opportunity, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair and members of the committee. I will be very brief. We have had opportunities this session to present testimony to both bodies, and we appreciate that opportunity. We were able, as a matter of fact, for MnCASA to come to you three times at the invitation of Chairs Paymar, Higgins, and Lesh to talk about the challenges that sexual assault advocacy programs face. So we do appreciate and acknowledge the interest and concern you have shown for what we are dealing with. Nothing has changed, essentially, since the last time we spoke with you regarding the impact on victims of sexual violence by any of the cuts that you might be looking at. What has changed now is that you have in front of you two proposals. And I am just here to say that we really do support and prefer the House proposal, and we see that it is the one that reflects the least negative impact on advocacy programs and the services that we provide. In fact, the Senate proposal would set back services 10 years in terms of the funding level. Thank you, and I will now turn things over to Cindy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Excuse my voice. I'm having a little problem with that, but I wanted to kind of paint a picture for you tonight about the context in which crime victim services programs find themselves in these economic times, and to help you in your determinations as you make these incredibly difficult decisions. Along with the proposed cuts to their state funding, crime victim programs are faced with what I'm calling kind of a trifecta of financial threats. They're faced with cuts from their local units of government, cuts from individual donors as unemployment increases, and cuts from foundations as foundation funding decreases because of their investments. At the same time, stressful economic times increase the vulnerability and dramatically affects the safety of the people that crime victim programs serve. So just looking at domestic violence, which is my area of expertise, for example, deteriorating financial circumstances faced by battered women who have lost jobs, housing, or health care place them at greater risk for abuse and at the same time increase the demand for shelters and advocacy programs. Right now, many victims are unable to meet even their most basic needs, from housing, food, to safety. That's just the beginning. Cuts to other kinds of programs like legal aid, law enforcement, the courts, corrections, probation, the kind of things we've been hearing so far this evening, also place increased demands on advocacy programs as they try to fill some of those gaps. So very realistically, cuts to court hours, cuts to court clerks, places an additional burden on the legal advocacy programs who assist women with filing protection orders, for example. We're hearing reports across the state about increased severity of violence, along with increased access as batterers lose their jobs and find themselves home with their families in greater numbers. Meanwhile, victims who are in shelter are having trouble finding jobs and affordable housing, leading to increased length of stay in shelters and an increased turnaway rate for other women seeking safety. As shelters and safe homes become increasingly scarce or full, this leads to women staying longer in unsafe home situations and leaves them more vulnerable to continued violence. So of the 150 domestic violence, sexual assault, abused children, and general crime programs across the state, they provide a safety net that no other kind of organization provides in this state. And from our point of view, and I hope from yours as well, providing for the safety of its citizens is one of the most important things that the state can do. I urge you to maintain adequate funding for crime victim services and to limit the impact of the state budget cuts on these life-saving programs. So thank you very much tonight.
Thank you. I hope your voice gets better soon.
Yeah.
It's really hard to listen to it.
I'm really
it
sorry.
So painful.
I'm sorry. Oh. I do have an appointment.
Oh, okay. Good. I'm trying to remember that the federal stimulus funds call out specific funding for sexual violence prevention and battered women's programs and those kinds of things. Can you tell me how much, or do you have any idea yet how much Minnesota will get through that?
Madam Chair, I'll defer to
Ms. Dunn.
Madam Chair, there are several sources of stimulus funding, and we have heard Jerry Boisvert from the Office of Justice Programs indicate that they are interested in targeting whatever stimulus funds come in terms of direct services for crime victims would be used to help fill any gap that results as a result or that comes as a result of your decisions. I rather think that she is thinking that we might be able to just with the House proposal remain perhaps at an even keel. You know, the increase that we appreciated a couple at the last session, about half of that came out of one-time funds, and half of it came out of became put into the base. We know that we are not going to appreciate and realize the one-time funding again, but if we could hold our own on the base funding, most likely the stimulus funds would be able to cover what we would lose from the one-time funding. That's how I understand Ms. Boisvert as looking at the stimulus funds helping us out.
It looks like the Violence Against Women Act funds for 2010 are up $1.2 million, and 2011 are a little less than that. And the Stop VOCA information is $500,000 for 2010 and not quite $200,000 for 2011.
Madam Chair, if I may, the VAWA funds, the Stop VAWA funds that come to the state, not all of those are for direct service. About probably half of the funding is for special projects regarding law enforcement, prosecutors, and the courts. And so the amount of funding that comes to support advocacy services is not the entire amount of Stop VAWA funding that comes into the state of Minnesota from the federal government.
Thank you. It's
thank
nice
you
to see you
much.
Both.
Thank you.
Niall Zickmund or Sherry Munyon? Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sherry Munyon, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Fire Association's coalition, and we want to express concern about the cuts to the fire safety account with a brief reminder that those are revenues collected from the surcharge on homeowner fees, and it already helps out the general fund by putting in the $2.2 million annually and covers the cost of the state fire marshal. The remainder of those revenues are intended to assist our firefighters throughout the state, about 21,000 firefighters, cover the costs of training, which assists in those local government obligations to help those firefighters. 18,000 of those firefighters are volunteers, and they're very concerned that this is the second biennium where they have to face the cuts to training. This year, the first year that funds were actually available for training, in about a 2 to 4 month period that process was developed, about a third of the departments had applied for training reimbursement funds, and there were $2.2 million of requests for about $800,000 in available revenues. So they're desperately hoping to see the pot of money for training and education increase, and we hope that as you deliberate and go through the bill, you'll be able to find a way to mitigate the impact to the fire safety account.
Thank you. Senator Moore.
Ms. Manion, when the firefighters don't get their training dollars reimbursed from the fire safety account, how do they pay for their training?
Local governments, Madam Chair, Senator, local governments assist in supplying revenues for reimbursement for training. Departments hold fundraisers to raise funds for their departments. So that's how it's generally done. One of the issues that we have is, in addition to this, is the local government aid cuts reduce amount of revenues available for training. And there are departments who bring on their volunteer firefighters and don't have training dollars available. And there are departments who just aren't able to bring on new firefighters because of the lack of training funds.
So, Madam Chair, my concern here is that if we need to do this in this division to contribute to the cuts that we have to make, I sure hope that members of this conference committee are cognizant that the LGA cuts that will have to take place will be a double hit on public safety and firefighters at the local level. So it would be disingenuous to say that we're the ones who are somehow taking away from firefighters if not everybody is fighting tooth and nail to make sure that we keep them whole in local government aid.
Thank you. Good reminder. Thanks, Ms. Manion. I think we're probably at the point where people's eyes are glazing over, and you all have been very generous with your time tonight here in the audience, and we appreciate hearing from you all. Just a couple of end-of-the-meeting notes. I want to thank Carissa Meslowski, who is our committee page in the Senate. She's put together all the bookbinders for us and generally keeps us running well. She does a great job for us, and so I wanted to be sure to thank her for all the work that she's done so far and that she's going to do to get us through to the end of this. Members, I believe we're going to share this room with the Judiciary Policy Conference Committee. So we'll be packing up the folders or the binders here for us. If you need to take it with you, go right ahead, but remember to bring it back tomorrow. Otherwise, leave it here, and we'll make sure that it's updated with any more information that we get for you, and we'll have it for the next meeting. And I will turn it over to Representative Paymar to give us an idea of what we're going to do tomorrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that it's best that we just keep plowing ahead. I mean, I think that there's some distinct differences between our bills, and this is going to get maybe it's more seems more complicated than it is, but I think we have a lot of work to do, so I it's my intention that we'll meet at 6 o'clock tomorrow night and spend a few hours and see what we agree with and get that out of the way, and then Friday, if we meet Senator Higgins, then we can maybe bring some of the agencies back or whatever you want to do. But I think there's some things that are fairly similar in our bills. We can dispose of them right away, so that's...
And if you would all make plans for being available on the weekend, both days, I think that we will be in that kind of position. We'll try not to work Friday night. I know we have people who have dates. Senator Foley does with his wife. So any other last comments?
Madam Chair,
Senator Foley?
I'm just curious to know whether the staff had enough time to complete anything that we needed to work on.
Is there anything that you folks need at this point that we can assist you with or give you some more time? Everybody looks pretty content. Okay.
Sure.
Senator Letts.
Well, I assume from your comment that you do not plan to meet during the day on Friday, is that?
I do plan to meet during the day, but not in the evening.
Okay.
All right. Anything else? Thank you all. We're adjourned.